I have some concerns with regards to how the housing is going to be allocated along the corridor. There's nothing to say that it's going to be an equal distribution along the entire corridor. And in fact, as was discussed earlier today, a significant portion of the funding that's already been identified is on the inner east side urban renewal area. And as my understanding is, that money's tied to that urban renewal area. You know, people may correct me if I'm wrong. That means that a significant portion of what's already been identified is going to wind up in inner East Portland and leaving a significant portion to be found for outer East Portland. With that said, I'd also like to talk about the underlying transportation project. I have been beating the drum for a significant long time about the nature of this project. I'm glad to hear that it was mostly referred to as a high-capacity transit and project and not a bus rapid transit, because frankly, in my eyes, I don't see this as being a bus rapid transit project. It may meet the federal standards for a bus rapid transit project, but those standards are frankly fairly low. There's significant issues as to whether or not there's going to be any increased savings in time given the alignment. There will be savings over the PAL division alignment, but the only savings of time that I see are from the elimination of bus stops and priority lighting systems at major intersections. There's nothing to say that those buses aren't going to get stuck in traffic along with everybody else in rush hour, and that's going to significantly impact both the time that it takes as well as reliability. The other major issue that I have with this is that there is a significant reduction in bus stops that are being proposed now for both inner division and outer division. As a person who lives in outer division or near outer division, I can tell you that the street grid does not really afford to have a significant reduction in bus stops without causing a major impact on the people that are going to lose the stations or stops that they're currently using. That means people are going to walk farther and walk through and that's going to be walking further through unimproved streets. That's not a good thing. East Portland Action Plan has said that it cannot support a project that is going to negatively impact people when it comes to transportation. What this plan currently being in its current iteration is essentially borrowing from Peter on division so that TriMet can expand east or north-south service on 184th and 162nd. I don't think that that's equitable, that a portion of East Portland should have to lose service to provide service for another portion of East Portland. Having said that, I'll wait to make a final analysis on that issue when TriMet and Metro come up with their final numbers. But as I currently look at the information before me, those are the conclusions that I've come up with. Thank you.
Mr. Marks, has the East Portland Action Plan sent us a letter or taken a position on the action plan on this particular local action plan?
It has, and I can forward a copy of that to you. Essentially, East Portland Action Plan's position is that mitigation measures have to be taken to alleviate displacement effects from the project, that there needs to be economic supports for local businesses, and that there should not be a negative impact on transportation or on the transit riders that currently exist along Division.
Thanks. It's probably in my inbox, but I haven't been able to check that. Thank you.
I'm sure you have a lot of stuff in your inbox. So.
I've been away for 3 weeks. So I hardly dare look at it.
It's a serious backlog. OK. Okay, other questions for these leaders?
The one thing that I don't see in the list of particularly housing initiatives is getting in front of predatory speculative behavior around home ownership. So there's a big number for renters. One of the things we learned around the Albina plan and its the areas that we fell short were the stories of homeowners who were felt that they were victims of predatory agents and other folks and lost their homes as a result. The plan is heavy on renter protections. It has an economic development piece. I'm guessing that we could, in a 10-mile corridor of this dimension, I'm guessing we could come up with a pretty good database of single-family residences. And, you know, I know that I get a notice almost every week from BPS telling me about some planning project, so we have the mechanism. Should we be considering some kind of communication with homeowners, maybe even just targeting seniors, but thinking this through to give people information about this plan, some potential risks ahead, and providing them with information where they can get neutral advice as to how to evaluate unsolicited offers?
Flesh out a little bit in our 11 goals to community stability, and recognizing a lot of it was pretty heavy on the renter aspect because of, again, who's living along the corridor, but also recognizing that some of the long-term homeowners there also need tools. And so there's some suggestions in here, including providing long-term homeowners with a tax credit and also developing limited equity cooperatives as well.
Thanks to Measure 50, this is one area where it has at least a shock absorber effect as property values go up. But I would urge us to come back to this question and think about we've got communities that speak different languages. We've got probably, my guess is from my recollection, is you're going to have a lot of older adults in homes up and down this corridor. And at least with respect to home ownership, we ought to be thinking through a strategy to get people information. Because what they may first find out is someone knocking on their door with an unsolicited offer to buy their house ahead of actually knowing that there's a major transportation improvement coming. There are a lot of bad actors out there right now because there's a shortage of supply. And there's a lot of people that are using an imbalance in the marketplace. So maybe we could think, Mary,
yeah, that's a good idea.
Some way of getting something with our partners out to homeowners, just giving them a heads up.
Yeah, helpful.
Commissioner Smith, I noticed that the Planning Sustainability Commission held a hearing in January. Do you happen to remember whether that was a day meeting or an evening meeting, and was it well attended by community members?
I believe that we had five people testify, three of whom were steering committee members, so I would not say that we had a groundswell of community.
Was it during the day or in the evening?
I don't recall.
Cam
says it was during the day.
I'm a little concerned that we're holding a hearing about something which is obviously of great importance to the community at a time that it's very difficult for people to get here.
Yep, it's a fair point. Thank you all very much. Appreciate it. I know we wanted to hear from TriMet. I'm not sure, Alan, if you were signed up to speak, but I think we do want to hear from you. So we'll summon you even if you weren't planning to testify.
Mr. Mayor, thank you, and members of the commission. Why don't I say a few words, and then I'd be happy to answer any questions. Alan Leto with TriMet. I'm the Director of Planning and Policy. And we're very excited to be able to be working on this project with Metro and the city and the other partners. It's a great opportunity. Along the Line 4 division today, about almost 10,000 times a day, somebody gets on a bus. So this is a heavily used, heavily needed bus today, and we can deliver quicker, more reliable service for those folks. And as you know, probably all too well, the expectation is that this corridor is going to grow and the demand will grow. And so we can bring a project that's going to serve today's needs and provide the kind of capacity that's needed to support the city's visions and our expectations for providing transit that helps develop and realize the visions that communities have. I know there were a couple of questions I heard already, so I'll go ahead and jump in and try to answer
those.
Yeah,
please, the current estimated capital cost.
Sure. So just quickly, where we are with the project. We are in project development with the Federal Transit Administration, which is a formal step in the process of pursuing, securing funding, and developing and delivering the project. That means that they recognize that we are developing it. We are actually at a point where the efforts that we're doing now are matchable with future federal funds, assuming that the project is successful. And that puts us in a particular positive step with FTA. We are looking at a schedule that brings the steering committee to the point where hopefully they are able to make a specific recommendation about the alignment, the stations, the terminus by the end of this calendar year, and puts us into further engineering the environmental process, identifying mitigations and or potential impacts and mitigations during the following year, and then moving towards the finalization of the finance plan and getting under construction to the point where we can open in 2021. I wish we could do it faster. We'll continue to look at that, but it's still a process that needs to involve lots of people with lots of detail, and it's still a federal process, so there is some timeline along there. In terms of capital cost, we don't know exactly right now, but we do have a range of approximately from $175 million to approximately $225 million that is the very likely range of capital cost. And that really is, for this kind of a project, this kind of a transit project, much more so in some ways than a light rail project, which we are so familiar with, as our first true BRT project. There are still lots of details that need to be worked through, and individual intersection designs make a big difference. And as you heard from Duncan, you know, impacts at an individual intersection need to be worked through so that we can bring down those costs. And those kinds of work still needs to happen to narrow that range of costs down. With that, I'd just be happy to answer any questions.
Could you give me just some concepts of what would make for a bus rapid transit on Division? It's hard for me to imagine, when it's such a congested street right now, how what kinds of things you could do to make a bus go faster than a car.
Right. A few things. One is the entire length, obviously, of Division has very different characteristics. If you think about what Division it looks like at 28th, it's very different from what it looks like at 148th. And that's the great character of this kind of bus-based investment, that it is nimble enough to be able to deal with and provide benefits in both kinds of environments. In terms of generically across the alignment, what we're looking at is using stations with better amenities, better crossings, better improvements so that we can attract people to those. Those would be the current proposed stations would be at places where approximately 74% of riders are getting on bus stops today. We would ask the remainder of folks to move to travel just a little bit farther to get to this more comfortable location, and that really reduces the variability in travel time, which means that we can schedule it faster, which means we get quicker travel, we get more reliability. Signal priority has been talked about, and that will be...
Just before you go on to the next thing, mm-hmm. The community member just said that cutting... Because what I heard what you say is that it's going to go faster because it won't stop as often.
Yes, that's absolutely true. There are only certain ways to speed up a transit vehicle. Light rail, even though it's in its own right-of-way, if we stopped every block, it would go very slowly. What we're looking for and what we're working with the steering committee and the community is, where is that right way to balance out, making sure that people can get to the service, but making sure that once you're on the service, it doesn't stop all the time.
So it would include things like adding sidewalks where there aren't any?
Yeah, not only adding sidewalks where they're needed, which thankfully I'm happy to say Division has been improving over time, so it's less dire than it was, but it's still not complete. It also includes ADA-compatible access at those stations and looking at that throughout the entire corridor so that it's not just, you know, nimble, healthy people who can make to the stations, but people who are traveling with using mobility devices as well.
Okay, so I interrupted you. One thing is fewer stations to make it go faster, and then you were going to say signal.
The signal priority, and we've been running with signal priority at various locations throughout the city for a number of years, but we're really on the next generation. They're much smarter. They're much more nimble and adaptive and able to provide additional travel times. Each individual's intersection, especially the large ones that really control what happens for travel throughout the corridor, gets a serious look at to look at whether there are ways to readjust the lanes, give us queue jumps so that we can get past the long line of cars close to the intersection and not have those sort of cases what that happens in the peak of the peak where you could lose 5 minutes at an intersection. If we can forestall that, we can move a lot faster during the peak as well.
But there's not that many places where you could add a lane, right?
Not a full lane the entire distance, but what it takes is, and this corridor, like a number of other corridors, but not always, there are some key intersections that really control everything. So, you know, starting from downtown, some of the key ones are 11th, 12th, Cesar Chavez, 82nd, 122nd. So it doesn't need a treatment everywhere. It needs treatments at those key intersections, and that can be something like a right turn only accept bus that doesn't dramatically negatively impact the cars moving, but does move the bus ahead.
If you're talking about essentially a single lane road, where you're getting a preference at the intersection, how do you deal with the backup beyond that? And I'm thinking that the last time I had a great experience with BRT was taking a bus from Denver to Boulder. But the singular feature about that trip, other than in addition to the nice bus and all the infrastructure they built, was it was on a dedicated lane on a highway. So it had a preferential route.
Right.
So what do you do? I mean, Division, for example, through most of the day is clogged. And when you get into the restaurant section and closer in, it's almost impossible to move at any time. So how does a BRT, other than giving them a preference at an intersection, how do you deal with that congestion? And frankly, yeah. And I'm just going to the part in the 20s and 30s with all the restaurants, there are times during the day when part of the blockage is cars trying to look for parking. And it takes a couple of cars trying to park in a tight spot, and that's a couple of minutes. So how do you deal with that challenge?
Right, and Division, the way it's developed and the way I think we anticipate it's going to continue to develop is exactly the kind of place where it needs this ability to carry more people, to attract more people to the transit so that development can happen without even more of the kind of swirling for parking and all of that activity. What we're looking at is, despite the feel of that section, what's often happening is that there are those key intersections that are causing backups that are kind of disrupting everything. Almost in that section, almost no matter what we do, we'll be running a little bit faster with those kinds of treatments. But we're looking at some key intersections to see whether we can actually improve the way the overall traffic system flows through that intersection so that buses can take advantage of that as well. Great example is whether we can do anything at 11th, 12th to be able to mitigate the impacts of the freight rail crossing at that intersection where sometimes that just blocks up. If we can just look at some reconfiguring of what happens there,
hey,
we can move everybody
that.
Through.
I'm all for that. Nothing's easy, though, and I'm guessing that runs up against Vision Zero at some point because if you time the lights and you encourage people and you give people a greater flow, probably people take advantage by going at a faster pace. But given the sequencing on that street, I think aligning the lights is a great idea. I don't know whether
absolutely.
It has an unintended consequence.
Absolutely. And we've been a strong partner and a strong proponent of the city's Vision Zero efforts. And I'd tell you what happens with that is all we need is for people to keep moving, not to move really quickly. So we very much want to provide a great transit service in a place where people can comfortably and safely cross the street as well.
So are there any other strategies to make the bus go faster?
That boils it down, but we can really look at, there are lots of kind of smaller details that really add up when you're talking about a line this long. We've kind of invested our design team with the idea that every second counts. So these are different buses than what we've typically seen. These are three-door buses with all-door boarding. They'd be using the Hop Fast Pass to be able to get people on and off as quickly as possible. So it'll feel more like a light rail in terms of boarding and alighting, and that saves time. At most of the stations, we likely will be able to allow folks with mobility devices and strollers and whatever else to board at the second door, much like a streetcar with a bridge plate, which is much easier and quicker to be able to load than it is at the front. And all of those little individual pieces add up on every single trip so that we end up with a faster trip and a more reliable trip than we would with typical service.
So this would involve developing and buying buses specifically for that line?
Exactly, yes.
And how much would that cost?
It's part of the cost that I already mentioned. I wouldn't want to tell you right off the top of my head. But they're a premium. They're something close to, a typical 40-foot bus is around $500,000, and we're talking in the $800,000 range, something like that. So the additional space comes with a premium, but you get a lot of benefits out of it.
And buses like that exist?
Oh, absolutely.
And given the pilot project you're in with the federal government for using electric buses on regular service, maybe this will be the first all-electric corridor.
We would love to. There's always, of course, the cost question, but this would be a wonderful place to try
that. Additional resources that might come available for that.
Sure, Gene is doing a good job of reminding me. The other thing I should mention in terms of timing is that I mentioned the locally preferred alternative decision that needs to be made to be able to move forward on the project. And the timing would be once we get a recommendation from the steering committee, then it needs to come back to the jurisdictions, including the city of Portland, for your affirmation or adjustment of that locally preferred alternative. And that would be in the late this calendar year.
So that's of concern to me, too, because we've got the kind of the framework here. But often when projects like this with multi-jurisdictions come back to us, we're told, well, you can't change it now because everybody else has agreed to it, or this is the consensus. So I'm nervous about hearing from the East Portland Action Plan representative that it's not acceptable to them to cut out the number of stops. If that's the way you get your speed, and what do I do when you come back?
Well, it's our job to continue to work with the folks that you saw and the folks at EPAP to work through that as well as possible, so that our hope, obviously, is that we bring you something that you can be comfortable with.
Have you analyzed what would happen if you just ran the buses more frequently so that there wouldn't be as many people getting on at the stops, or they wouldn't necessarily have to stop at every stop? Because that's what happens in Europe, is that there's a bus every 10 minutes. Nobody checks to find out when it's coming because it's going to come, and it stops when you ask it to, but not otherwise.
I'll give you one cautionary flag on that, and it's the number 12 bus at peak time. And what I've observed is that they end up getting stacked. And they get stacked. I'm not saying that happens everywhere, but on the number 12, they get stacked, and then it actually is a huge drag because they all stop at the end sequence, and you're just backed up.
And as a rider, as a frequent rider of the 12 Sandy, I can tell you I'm very aware of that. We call it bus bunching. What happens is one bus gets just a little bit behind, and then they get a kind of an overly large load. They start slowing down, the next one. And then what we have to do is we skip. And that actually really frustrates our riders, because you're standing at a bus stop and a bus goes by you and they're kind of pointing at the bus behind them that they may or not be able to see, and turns into a lot of understandable complaints. Being able to have something that reliably shows up consistently on the Line 4 division, we have something like 5-minute headways during the peaks right now, but it's lumpy. And if we can smooth that out and have vehicles that each vehicle has more capacity, so we can bring more people on and not risk those pass-ups, we'll be doing a great service to our riders.
Thank you.
Other questions for for Alan or Gina. Thank you both. Thank you both very much.
Thank you.
Other folks that want to speak this afternoon, Ms. Boyson, others?
I have one person signed up, Lori Boyson.
Come on up. You looked prepared, so that's why I called on you specifically.
Thank you very much. I'm Lori Boyson. I'm the Executive Director for the Division Midway Alliance, and I'm also a steering committee member on the Powell Division Transit and Development Project. I snuck in on Bob, or he would have, I'm sure, recognized me. Mayor Hales and commissioners, I want to thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about the Portland Action Plan as it relates to this project. I am not going to reiterate what the other committee members said. I echo their sentiments. I encourage you to adopt this Portland Action Plan. I believe that this plan is the result of collaborative work between city bureaus, all city bureaus, community organizations, Metro, and TriMet. It provides much-needed community stability actions to a transit project that can jeopardize a tenuous housing crisis in an already vulnerable community. I'm happy to see the business and technical assistance and workforce development tools addressed. And while this section provides a broad overview of workforce and economic development, I encourage the council to adopt specific tools that will feed this. Specifically, as an East Portland Action Plan representative to the Metropolitan Alliance for Workforce Equity, I have come to believe that the most important tool we can use to make sure the project benefits current businesses and residents is to adopt community benefits agreements similar to the pilot CBA developed for the Water Bureau projects. Deliverables on that project exceeded projected goals and achieved excellent results. For example, the goal for journey level hours worked by people of color was 18%. The CBA pilot achieved 25%. Minority and women-owned firms and minority apprenticeship participation was over double the stated goal, and female apprenticeship participation was triple the goal, or nearly 30% of total project hours. Utilizing local and minority hiring through a CBA would directly impact residents living along the corridor by providing not only much-needed living wage jobs, but eventual professions to these residents. Those residents will in turn spend money in those local businesses, improving those businesses as well. Community benefits agreements do work. Seattle found them so beneficial, it has established a threshold by which any public project that meets the criteria automatically triggers a CBA, and I encourage the City of Portland to adopt a similar model. I also wanted to just quickly address to you, Commissioner Fish, I love your idea about creating some type of model for mobile home parks as an affordable housing. And I encourage you to visit the Rolling Wills Mobile Home Park at 143rd and Division. They are renovating their property in an amazing manner. They're replacing mobile homes with updated units. They are greening. They have their own swimming pool. It's an amazing place, and I recommend that you check it out. I want to again thank you for your time, and I hope that you please adopt the Powell Division Transit and Development Project and the Portland Action Plan. Okay.
Laurie, thank you for your testimony. Could you tell me about the community benefit agreement? Is that included in the document here?
It is not included in the document. It's something that we have talked about, and it is a tool that the East Portland Action Plan, it's an anti-displacement tool that they have recommended. They went through a very, very long process, I'm sure you're aware of, to pull out tools. And two of the three groups that worked on that identified community benefits agreements as what they felt was a very important tool to use. It's because you are actually bringing people to work in your communities, and it's just very beneficial. And it's, you know, I don't have this is plan 1, 2, 3. But
my question is, should that be in this action plan?
It should be added, yes.
Was it discussed by the steering committee?
I don't remember. I don't recall.
But it's certainly something that East Portland Action Plan has.
It's something East Portland Action Plan definitely is behind.
And what's your feedback, working in the district for a long time, about the question of fewer bus stops?
We've worked with TriMet for quite some time. We spent hours this past fall, which kind of talks to what Kate was talking about. reaching out to our communities and identifying and finding community members and talking to them about what was going on. I think about the work that I do for my community, and over 50% of my time was being spent just on outreach for BRT. When we learned that bus stops were going to be taken, a large percentage of bus stops, large percent of our of the population in our district was going to be losing their stops. We worked with Alan and Elizabeth and Metro and City of Portland to add on a few more stops that we were concerned about, that, that were large numbers of people were getting on and off. At this point, my concern is there are so few stops. There are so few stops being taken out that is it, it to me, it's like, how rapid will this transit be? And I'm still waiting, as Kim is, as many of us are, I'm waiting for those numbers. I want to see today, if you travel from 174th to 11th on line 4, it takes, I don't know, an hour and 35 minutes. If we have the bus rapid transit, it will take an hour and 20 minutes. I want to know the differences. I want to know the numbers. And I also want to know, what's the difference between 82nd to 11th? What's the difference from 82nd to 174th? And those are the kinds of things that we at the steering committee level are looking at and then passing on to our community members and talking to them about and getting feedback from them saying, what do you want to see here? You're not happy with this? Great. We take it back to them.
So then why should we? Why are you recommending that we adopt this plan today?
Because I think the time is right now. I feel like if we, we're moving along in a timeline. We need to move forward with this timeline. We've made huge headway with this project. I believe an action plan is not something that I believe it changes. I don't think it's static. I believe that as we move forward, a community benefits agreement today is not necessary until we start doing construction, but it's something we need to start looking at, and it's something that you as council have the authority to authorize.
So when we adopted the East Portland Action Plan, which Commissioner Fish and I remember as one of the greatest things we did in the first year of our terms, we promised that we were absolutely going to do it. And each year, the East Portland Action Plan group comes back to us and you tell us these things you've done, these things are still pending. I'm concerned that we can't, I don't want to promise to, I don't want to adopt this plan when I can't make that promise on this. I can't tell you that I'm going to be able to allocate more funding for this.
You can't make the promise to allocate additional funding for what? I'm sorry.
For the implementation of the, this local action plan. When the staff are telling me that it in order to do it, it requires another at least $500,000 of ongoing money in one area.
And I guess then I would put it upon council to look to figure out how to. I love what Commissioner Fish said, that in some cases you are required to have a certain amount of mitigation fund, and in this case it isn't. I would think it would be really wonderful to see council step to that level and say, you know what, we are going to commit to this because we understand that this is a way to bring equity to East Portland, that this is a tool that, as Vivian said earlier, we need this now, and if we don't start this now, and at planning and sustainability, same type of thing. These conversations began because community said, great, you're doing this transit project. What's going to happen to all the people who are living here who can no longer afford to live here? If we as community members had not said that, we would have moved forward. Now we're saying move forward with this plan because we have to, the time is now for us to move forward. If we wait, it may be too late.
Thank you.
Good point. Thank you. Other questions?
I have another question for TriMet, actually.
Okay.
Sorry.
Come on up, Alan. Round two.
Because I ride the 12, but the other way to Southwest. And there it's at rush hour, you have the option of the 94, which stops once between 7 miles out and downtown, and similarly coming back. Or you can get the 12, which stops all along the way.
Right.
So is that being considered for a division so that you wouldn't have to take out all of the stops?
Not for division. We thought about that early on and discarded that. That kind of service does not come with any additional capital resources from the federal government. It does not come with a ability to provide service throughout the day so that it helps a very small number of riders. So it's something that we're looking at in terms of the corridor. this corridor seems appropriate to bring a improvement that helps all of the riders throughout the day, 7 days a week.
Except those who are living between the stops.
I would argue, and we've certainly talked to plenty of folks who have indicated that they seem to agree with this, that walking just a little bit farther to be able to have a much more comfortable station and have a more reliable and quicker ride is of total benefit.
Thank you.
But other questions? And I'm not sure if there's anyone else who wanted to speak. I know we had more questions for you, but okay, maybe perhaps not.
I would just call for, can we have a council discussion before we take a vote?
Sure.
So, Steve, can I follow up on a couple points? One of my takeaways on this is that if there was ever a capital construction project that cried out for the highest level of coordination between all of the bureaus and some other partners, this is it. And so to the extent you've been taking the lead on this effort to get everybody to coordinate the work they do, I think the one thing that the one headwind here that could really work against what you're trying to do, since we're talking about potentially upgraded streets, sidewalks, the addition of things like bioswales, the ongoing work with water and sewer, new construction, which, by the way, whenever there's new construction, we seem to mysteriously lose a lane, and on and on and on. I think if there was ever a time that we need to map this out and coordinate the timing of investments and major construction projects along this corridor, this cries out for it, because we could end up creating essentially a gauntlet that even if you painted the bus red and gave it a fire engine siren, you're not going to get through if we're not coordinating this effort. So that's something Steve's taking the lead on. Obviously, PBOT, BES, Water, and others, and then some utilities are working on. It just seems to me this is a good one for us to focus on, the way we did earlier. You know, we've done on, say, Division at a smaller scale. And I would encourage you and Leah to convene all the bureaus that have a dog in this fight so we start thinking about how we time capital construction work.
Well, I think BPS is officially the lead in all of this, so I rely on them to convene everybody. But that's somewhat jokingly. But no, we need to do that, but we all need to be involved.
On the home ownership side, I guess I would just say to Kurt, can we just investigate whether there is a database that we could call upon, we could find? I mean, we seem to mail out a lot of things to the public. And so I would love to know what's the universe of single-family residences that we could communicate with and who we might partner with on that. And maybe we partner with Elders in Action to target just older adults first, or maybe we partner with some culturally specific groups to talk to people. I'm going to just, in advance of the vote and the discussion, just address something my friend and colleague Commissioner Fritz just said about funding. Because as everyone knows, we cannot today commit a future council to a spending commitment. So we can't do that. And so we're not saying today that the council next year and the year after is going to spend X dollars. What this plan contemplates, as I look at the backup documents, is a lot of non-general fund money being allocated to this task in a creative way. So going through all the new tools at the Housing Bureau and looking for ways through the HIF, through the securitization of Airbnb revenue, to everything else, finding a way and saying, yeah, we're going to come to council every year and say, here's our chunk that we can dedicate to this goal and to closing the delta. And if some of our assumptions are unduly modest about revenue we're going to get from some of these new tools in the toolkit, then we can use non-general fund revenues to close that gap. But what I anticipate is an annual forum in which we discuss how to get there. And Commissioner Fritz is right. We can't commit here to the future general fund money. And worst case scenario, in 2 or 3 years, we're in a recession. And we're not going to say we're going to fund this and then turn around and cut out a community center in the heart of this community. So, but I'm encouraged by the amount of non-general fund sources that we can tap. And what I read this to be is a commitment to pull as much of that as possible and focus it on the corridor. So that's how I'm going to interpret it. And then I will go out to 143rd Division, and I appreciate that. And since we make modular housing in Oregon, And since we know how to green up these sites, I just want to take a couple of these things and have the city and county commit to transforming them, because I think with a little ingenuity, we could turn these into not only very desirable and attractive places to live, but we could put the green value system in it and make them sustainable. And then on the CBA issue, I mean, so most of the money we're talking about today is city money. And most of it is already governed by policies. So the housing money has a whole set of strings attached to it. What I hear Lori saying is that the federal fund piece and the TriMet piece, we need to be thinking about what is the community benefits component of that. I know TriMet has federal requirements it has to meet. We're going to be coming to council in September with a report on the numbers on the CBAs that were used under the Water Bureau pilot, and we'll have a broader community discussion about how's that working, does it need to be tailored, and other things. I think where we're probably headed is what we call a community benefits plan, which is a more targeted version of a CBA. But the goal we share, and so I guess I would just close by asking our friends at TriMet, since this is not directly implicated in what's before us today, will we have a chance to have that conversation about how to bring the values behind a community benefits plan to the capital construction side?
And absolutely, without knowing what any of the details are, we're very much eager to have those kinds of conversations so that the benefits to the corridor are not just on the transit side. What the details of that still to be worked out, obviously.
Okay. Thank you.
Other questions or comments?
Sorry, I am concerned about the affordable housing, because according to the chart on page 28, most of it is in the Clinton Triangle. It's not along the corridor. There's 500,000 for outside of the Clinton Triangle and 5.5 million within the Clinton Triangle. So how are we going to address the concern that it should benefit outer east rather than, or as well as inner east?
You're on, Kurt. I think this is on. I appreciate you pointing that out. And indeed, the Clinton Triangle is a major area of interest and focus. However, it's not the only one. One thing that I did not mention was that as we work through the summer, and Vivian Satterfield, who spoke to you earlier from OPAL, is on the panel of experts for the Inclusionary Housing Program, we're scheduled to come back to council with a construct of what the calibration of inclusionary housing requirements would likely be come September. And if you look at the residual land values in East Portland, it does not argue that you could get very many units through private development mandates, mandatory inclusionary zoning. However, I've asked staff specifically to focus on areas where transit improvements are being made and push the envelope on the inclusionary units with the expectation that we would offset those costs more robustly for private developers in areas such as this. So that's going to tap the private market hydraulics throughout the entire length of the corridor, and I think that will be helpful. The CET is how we would pay for that, and we don't have to take title to those properties. We just need to incentivize a private developer to do it.
But that's not included in the table, so I don't understand.
Right. Well, the table was done like before the legislature even approved inclusionary housing. And perhaps, an amendment would be useful, because I'm citing tools that weren't even available to the Bureau when this plan was developed.
If you remember the summary slide that I showed earlier, and this is a good catch if the table is not actually reflecting this, a big part of how we're thinking about the next 5 years of the affordable housing piece of this is a share of the new resources that are just coming forward now, as well as programs that even since we started this planning project, housing's been able to secure through different sources and been able to identify how they can target someone on the corridor. It's a five-year plan. One of the things that we thought was really critical was to give the City Council a sense of the order of magnitude of cost of lift it is to even attempt to meet some objectives like this, both on the housing and the economic development side, and to fairly represent to City Council sort of what we had in hand today and then what we need to continue to work on through one means or another to secure to be able to follow through on this scale of effort. So that's part of having a gap in funding at this point of a five-year plan like that is less of a reason not to try to move forward with it, but more of putting a financial goal on it as well as a 300-unit goal for the housing as well as the number of businesses we hope to assist on the economic development side. You sort of have to do both to even have know what you're shooting at. And so I just encourage folks to think of the plan and the budget in those terms. The story that the Bureau of Housing's been able to, the Housing Bureau has been able to tell now is representative of how much things can change over the a period of a plan to bring more resources to the table. And then the last piece of it is this, I encourage us to think about. The housing needs, just on the housing side, and I think it's true on the economic development side, the needs in the city in a lot of the neighborhoods are way bigger than what we're talking about just in this action plan, much larger than, you know, you even really see just in this quarter. The needs are big in the quarter, but there's more beyond that. We're focusing on this quarter now because we think there's something to leverage with this transit investment. What's the right sort of proportional scale to try to capture that moment of leverage? There are other places in the city where we can mount similar efforts where we just don't have a transit project to try to leverage. So this isn't the only action that we need to be thinking of in terms of housing and economic development in the city. This is a scale of effort tied to making the most of what's going to be a big capital investment as well. If the project goes forward, if it can come back and demonstrate the transit advantages that we think it's going to have, and that's going to have to be presented to the community and satisfy those concerns, as well as come back through City Council.
Joe, I think it's good to have stretch goals. Part of me says I'm not sure we've stretched enough, but it is a sober goal. And you guys can't say this, but in addition to all the tools that Kurt has rattled off that are a tribute to the good work that Kurt and Dan have done to bring these things forward and give us additional tools in our toolkit, it is possible that the Portland voters are going to give us another tool later this year. And that's another pot of money that can be tapped to meet our goals here. And I think stretch goals in this area make sense.
So this resolution says that we're going to adopt this plan as non-binding city policy. But then it goes on to resolve that, certainly we do gratefully acknowledge the excellent work and dedication of the steering committee. The third be it resolved, though, says that we will work with regional partners to implement the local action plan and to continue to participating in the broader Powell Division Transit and Development Project. We haven't had a public hearing at this council where we've had a lot of robust community input to say, do they even want this? So what I'm hearing from the community today is if we do the project, then this is what's necessary to make it work for the community at a minimum. My understanding is that we will still at some point have a public hearing on, are we going to support doing this project?
Yes. The schedule shows that the locally preferred alternative, which is the transit piece of this, is supposed to come out of the steering committee this fall, Commissioner. A public hearing on that will take place in front of the City Council after it's come out as a recommendation from the project. So a lot of the issues that were talked about today and the technical analysis that the community was even saying it needs to see to know how it's going to come down on this project will come into place between now and those decision points. And it will be at a hearing in front of City Council. And there will be some form of local match that goes into the project. So the City Council has several points of leverage over the future of this project. The Community Action Plan is at least letting the community and the steering committee know now, if the project goes forward, here's what we think we've set as the objective. And I'm from the Bureau of Planning and Sustainability. I like to think that actions stem from these plans, but with or without the transit project, the Metro money is on the table to begin this work in the current fiscal year, and the work is necessary, so it's worthwhile to move forward, and we're appreciative of that contribution to this.
Thank you. And I'm still concerned about the community organizer position and the, how it interacts with the neighborhood associations as well as with Venture Portland. So since we only have the Metro money for this year, am I assured that the position will be hired as a limited-term position?
I guess I'm going to ask Kate to confirm that from PDC, since that part of the Metro grant is going to be directly go to PDC and the MPI districts.
Right. Just to clarify, the money is not being hired to add another position at PDC. We're working with Division Midway to have that position at their office, and it'll be hired by them, managed by them, and so that is the plans are already in the works with that, with the grant money and with the PDC e-zone money that we community contribution money.
So Division Midway is aware that it's a limited term position. We're not guaranteeing funding for the full 5 years.
I believe they are. Yeah.
I see Laurie nodding. So. Thank you. And I know that your Division Midway and indeed all of the neighborhood prosperity initiatives are working well with the communities. So I just want to make sure that when we have a structure for community involvement, it gets used in the Office of Neighborhood Involvement, that we are coordinating it.
Right. Absolutely.
Thank
Absolutely.
You.
Absolutely.
What's the action? This is a resolution?
It's a resolution. And obviously then the LPA comes back this fall. So that's the process.
Thank you.
Okay. Any further discussion before we take action on the resolution? Then let's do that, please.
Saltzman.
Well, thank you to our Metro councilors and to everybody else who's participated in this Portland, the Division PAL Local Action Plan. I think it's a good plan, good questions about affordable housing, land use, and how we do this with buses quickly. And it's definitely a corridor in need of a lot of attention. So thank you. Aye.
I want to thank everybody who's been working on this plan. Thank you, Joe. Thank you, and thank you, Alan. And thanks to Epano and the Division Midway Alliance, my favorite World War II alliance, for their work on this. I appreciated what Lori said about this is an organic and iterative process. We're adopting this plan to make it clear that we understand that the community wants to be sure that a plan like this is implemented, and if it's not, then the serious question is whether we should go ahead with the transit project at all. But as Laurie said, it's not necessary to say we're going to tell TriMet to stop working on this plan until we know that we have precise funding for each to stop working on the transit project until we know we have the funding committed for every element of this plan. This is one step in a process, and we've been talking about what the next steps are going to be. I am delighted to hear Director Krieger say that given the new tools we have to address housing needs, he feels pretty comfortable that we should be able to come up with funding to address the housing component of this plan. And granted, 300 units is, you know, is not enough, but I mean, I think that a year ago we probably would have said, well, maybe we are going to ask TriMet to stop because we don't know how we're going to get money for any significant investment in housing. One thing I want to note is that we also have heard from folks in the community that in addition to investment in affordable housing, they'd like to see stronger tenant protections, and obviously our ability to adopt tenant protections is limited by state law. But we have a legislative session coming up. We have a work session planned on tenant protections in the council next month. So hopefully, in September. So hopefully we'll be able to show some progress on that at all, that as well. So I think that this is rather a new thing. And even, I think that Commissioner Fisher was asking earlier what the analogy is. I'm not sure that there is an analogy where before we're going ahead with the transit project, we're talking with the community about unintended consequences and coming up with a plan to address those unintended consequences and making it clear, as Commissioner Fritz said, that our commitment to the transit project is dependent on our ability to address to anticipate and address those unintended consequences. So I think that it's hard to come up with an analogy, but hopefully we will be think this way in future projects. And it may not be that there's some rigid formula that X percent of the money spent in a transit project goes to mitigation. I think it'll be a case-by-case determination, as this has been. So thank you all very, very much. Thanks to the Metro folks. Thanks to Commissioner Stacey. I'm pleased to vote aye.
These projects do become very complicated with multiple jurisdictions all doing their best and including citizens from multiple jurisdictions as well. So I appreciate that, and thanks very much to the steering committee and all of the staff work. This is actually, you know, the second project we've done like this, because we did the Barber Transit Plan looking at the concept of land use before we're actually sure of what's happening on Barber. And before that, we did the St. John's Lombard plan, and then we did the Sandy Boulevard Hollywood plan. In those last two, we haven't funded many of the recommendations that were aspirational in the plan, and we haven't actually funded a lot of the things that we're supposed to, that we're hoping to get done in Barber. Of course, in any kind of planning, you do the plan so that we agree on what the aspirations are, and then you go seek funding. But I want to make it very clear that I'm not sure that there is funding within the city for the action items that are in this plan, and I'm willing to support it as the roadmap for how to get there. We're going to have to think very carefully when we do have the locally preferred alternative, how do we get all of the other jurisdictions to pay their fair share and to make sure that collectively we can fund it, because that's, as we know with affordable housing, it's a metro-wide project problem and challenge, and yet a lot of the burden falls on Portland's taxpayers. So with those provisos, I will vote aye. Thank you.
Yes.
Well, this was, I just was looking at the agenda, and this was originally scheduled for an hour. We're now 2 hours into the discussion, and it's normally at this point that we look to find the person who's responsible for it, and the recriminations happen off camera. I actually am left feeling that this has not only been a very stimulating and thoughtful and interesting discussion for 2 hours, but I look forward to further discussions. And I want to begin by thanking everyone who took time out this afternoon to come shape this discussion. I think this is one of the best discussions we've had of this kind. And since we're sort of making it up as we go along, I guess, since there's not much of a precedent, I have found this incredibly interesting and provocative, so thank you to everybody. We're struggling with, in part, a problem of definition. We're calling this a goal, a framework, a roadmap. And I think what you're hearing is, because we have done big planning exercises in the past and have fallen short in terms of meeting the goals, council doesn't want to just embrace this and say, you know, you can assume that this will be funded and we're going to get it all done. But to use the analogy that Commissioner Fritz did a while ago about East Portland Action Plan, while we haven't funded everything in the Action Plan, and while there's a lot of stuff that is to be addressed, for me the great virtue of that process is that every year the community comes forward and says, these are our priorities, and we have a mechanism to actually act on them. And without that, we don't have the focus, and therefore we're what did Tom Potter once say? If you don't know where you're going, any road will get you there. And so I like the fact that it gives us focus. And my expectation is that at each budget year over the next 5 years, housing and planning and transportation, everyone else is going to come forward and give us an update and tell us where the delta is. And we'll have a chance to say, well, you know, Dan, let's put some more HIF in this, or so-and-so, let's bring some discretionary money. So it's going to focus our attention. I'm cautiously skeptical about whether we can fund this, but I also, my heart tells me this should be a floor, not a ceiling. And I know that's contradictory, but I don't know that we have enough housing units here. And the one piece, and Kurt would be, I'd be remiss if I didn't say this, I'm glad they're all going to be below 60%. I want to see the lion's share go to 0 to 30 and then match the demonstrated need within the corridor. And if you and Commissioner Saltzman come back and say that's families and two-bedroom units, that's fine with me. If it's single adults and seniors, that's fine with me. But I want to focus on where the greatest need is, and that's below 30%. So with those caveats and with the expectation that we'll have an annual process to evaluate this, either as a freestanding meeting or as through the budget, I'm pleased to support this, and I really appreciate the thoughtfulness of the community, and I'm hearing that there's stuff here that does not have unanimous approval, and there are some trade-offs. And I guess I'm going to go forward on this because I think this gives us a better chance to getting to yes than not doing anything. And I also think that we're at risk in government generally about spending too much time getting to no and not to yes. We got to start somewhere. So I'm going to support this and thank everyone who brought it forward. Bye.